Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. Now, I often talk to people with big goals, and that's part of why I love doing this Relax Back UK show. This time, I speak to a couple of medics who want to drag the NHS organisation of getting to see a specialist, arranging the necessary tests, etc., and getting treatment into the modern world.
Organising the specialist part of the healthcare, where you and I, most of your audience, will think about going and seeing a doctor in an outpatient setting in a hospital, is how can you bring that, which really hasn't changed for almost 100 years, into a modern era.
My guests are Dr. Baman Nadiat-Sakewi and Dr. Chris Peter, and they have given themselves this task. So listen to find out what they have done in this fantastic show. Thank you. At the start of my chat with Dr. Chris Peter and Dr. Baman Nadiat-Sakewi, I tried to lay out my understanding of their objectives as far as digital health and the NHS was concerned. The topic is digital health, but kind of not as we know it at the moment, really. I've had guests before talking about digital health as part of the, you know, the medical process, you know, AI being used in scans and gathering lots of information about our health from, you know, lots of people are wearing these watches now that gather all sorts of different information that can be useful to GPs and all sorts of things. But the impression I get, and you can tell me if I've got the wrong end of the stick, is we're looking at things a little bit differently. And this is the arranging and organizing of healthcare, and in the kind of a digital online hospital, you're calling it. Now, is that right? Have I kind of got the right end of the stick there?
Yes, very much so. So, Mike, hello to you and your audience. So I'm Baman. I'm a gastroenterologist by background, and you're absolutely correct. What we're doing, and it very much relates to what the NHS Online announcement from the government also is about, which referenced the work that we're doing, is organising the specialist part of the healthcare, where you and I, most of your audience, will think about going and seeing a doctor in an outpatient setting in a hospital, is how can you bring that, which really hasn't changed for almost 100 years, into a modern era where both in terms of the patient and doctor interface and interaction, you bring it into a digital world, but also in the background and how you run the services, you bring it up digitally.
Okay. So, I mean, my first thought is that sounds extraordinarily difficult. And I'm also taken back to when I first started doing computing at school, and I'm old enough for there to have been a computer room at school. And there was a sign on the wall and it said something like, to really foul things up, you need a computer. Like, to make mistakes is human, but to really foul it up, you need a computer. So this sounds like an enormous task. So my first question is this really possible? Can you make that happen? Either of you?
I'll go first. So the short answer is yes, you can. But to your point, when you're doing things digitally, you've got to be really extraordinarily careful because you're then scaling any type of error that you make across every single patient. So designing, building this kind of a system needs incredible rigor and a multidisciplinary approach between software scientists and engineering technology scientists to clinicians to specialist people who are specialized in that interface and how you create it. They're called clinical safety officers. So putting that all together on how you understand the entirety of the complexity of healthcare ecosystem, because no one person is the same and their medical conditions are different. How do you build something that you capture everybody, you don't lose people, that you put in the correct systems that it actually helps to flag patients up for you? But once you do that, then you actually go from a system where you are being much more reactive in an analog manual basis into something that enables you to become much more proactive, both in terms of an individual patient's healthcare, but also at system level. It will start having significant changes. You've got so much data to be able to monitor the doctors, you've to be able to understand that you haven't lost patients and pick them out before they deteriorate. So there's an enormous opportunity here to be brought. And we've been working on this for about 12 years now, certainly at Medifilm itself.
And I think just to reassure as well some of your listeners, perhaps, when we're talking about digital, we're talking about how the service is run and how we can put that patient in front of one of our expert consultants. From the patient perspective, they don't need to be scared of the digital bit. It doesn't mean that they're only going to be able to interact with us on an app. It doesn't mean that they're going to have advanced technological skills. What it means is, and this is Medifilm's way of working, is that when that referral is received by Medifilm, they will get a consultant review on our platform within 48 hours and a decision made about what next, whether that may be a phone call for the patient, it may be going straight to an investigation. So the digital doesn't have to be scary. It's about how we improve efficiency. It's about how we improve care. It's about how we link patients to expert opinions and investigations. From the patient perspective, it's about ultra fast, high quality, really, really good care.
Well, I've want to get into the different parts of the model in a moment, but just to go on the point about from the patient's point of view, because from the patient's point of view, really it's about waiting, isn't it? At the moment, there are long wait times. If you need a new knee, a new
Completely.
hip, whatever, everyone says, oh, I've got an appointment, but it's 8 months' time or what have you. So
Completely.
this is a very basic question. Are these long wait times generally the result of system and administration rather than a shortage of people with a scalpel who are waiting for someone to slice open and give them a new knee?
It's a combination. So there's certainly an issue that right now demand is somewhat outstripping capacity. But when you look at how the workforce is set up, when you look at the night, I mean, no doctor works 9 to 5, but if you think about how much they're contracted to do, but if you think about it from the amount of capacity of work that is available for doctors and staff to actually deliver, it's enormous. So one of the things that we've done at Medifilm in terms of workforce management is we enable consultants and doctors to treat one patient at a time in the smallest of units of time they have. So it's what we call micro time. So if you're a consultant and you have children, and because of that, you're part time, which there are lots of people like that, you can, whilst you're waiting, kind of between picking up children, help one patient. And when you add up all of those times that would have previously been wasted, because in the traditional way you locked into a 4-hour clinic, but now you can help a lot more patients. So the capacity is there, is how you bring it together, patch it together to actually get that capacity out and organize the whole system together.
The 100-year-old model that Baman talked about, which I still deliver every day in my care, is a GP refers a patient to me. They wait to come and see me in my room in the hospital. I then see them in that room in the hospital, and then I then send them for a test in my hospital, which has to be done in my hospital. And therefore, if you can imagine, there's lots of potential delays there. If that expert opinion could be done by any appropriate consultant anywhere in the country using the platform, and then if that investigative capacity could be used anywhere in the area, including the community hubs, then already you're shrinking that time down and using time more efficiently.
Does that mean, though, by the time one of your patients, Chris, gets to you on the slab, that could be the first time you've seen them or spoken to them? So all you're going is some notes that notes that have been generated in another part of the country. So when you slice open, you might find something you didn't expect.
Sure. Well, no, when with surgery is slightly different, but what we know is that actually more patients who are referred to surgery don't end up having an operation than do. Okay. And there's an awful lot of investigation and filtering done before it's decided patients need surgery. So even in a surgical specialty, if a patient is managed on one of these digital platforms, there is a lot that can be done to get them worked up and ready so that they may only need one appointment with their surgeon before they have the operation rather than three or four. So there's still a lot of efficiency to be gained by front loading lots of that workup, as we call it, for patients, so that then they come to see me with all of the information I need, and I can then recommend an operation to them and then do the operation.
All right.
I think this is the important point I was trying to make at the beginning, which is moving from the old model of care of one person carrying on every single interaction to actually scaling this up digitally. It's important how you look at the clinical pathways. So some conditions, like let's say you need an ultrasound. So a doctor can request an ultrasound, and it doesn't matter who does the ultrasound, and you get the result back, and you know you can kind of move on from there. But to your point of surgery, it will be completely inappropriate to go from somebody somewhere else saying, okay, I've now done the test and I know this patient potentially needs an operation, to then be finding the patient on the operating table of somebody else. So you need to build the clinical pathways as they are kind of safe for that. And it's one of the things we've spent.
This is your 12 years of development that you were talking about earlier, isn't it?
Yeah. And, and to your other thing about capacity, so we talked about clinical capacity, and Chris referenced the capacity of the other kind of diagnostic units as well. If you go back to immediately post-COVID, the government paid out to buy all the capacity of the independent sector hospitals, but the system wasn't there to make sure they're all utilized properly. So it's how do you make sure all of this capacity is organized in one cohesive way? That's the key to unlocking the capacity that is already there in the country.
Okay.
And we've got examples of that with Medifer, whereby we have someone needs an endoscopy. There may be four providers we can use for that endoscopy, and we can move those patients around in real time to make sure they have the shortest way possible. Whereas the traditional system would have a clinic and a doctor associated with one endoscopy unit. And therefore, if there's a delay, there's a delay.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Maybe a good thing to do would be to go through what might be a patient's kind of movement through this whole system. So through the model. Okay. So the first thing that is on the list, certainly in the information you sent out prior to this, was we're looking at triage, consultant-led triage of 48 hours. So what does that actually mean? If I've got something wrong with my knee, the first thing I do is I'll go and see the GP. Are you suggesting something different here?
Let's take the example of a patient who might have some reflux and abdominal pain. So if I may use my own speciality.
Sure.
So you've seen the patient has seen their GP, who says, look, I've done some tests, not really sure where to go from here. I'm going to send you for a review. So the first thing that would happen is a consultant would review that referral and assess the risk, because we know that downstream there may be capacity constraints. So there may be a waiting list for endoscopy because there's just not enough endoscopy providers in a particular location. So the first thing is to know what's, as a population of patients, what sort of risk are we dealing with? So let's say we now have 10 patients and we know that there is a waiting list for endoscopy, and patient number one gets a letter saying you've been reviewed by a consultant and your risk is red. The other one receives a letter that says your risk is green. And the red is told you're going to go first for a test. And the green one is told there may be a waiting list because there's just not enough capacity for endoscopy. If your symptoms change whilst you're waiting, please contact us. We will reassess you. And we've got evidence of this. And about 10% post-COVID, as we were kind of all the patients were going through diagnostics, about 10% of patients were calling us saying my symptoms are worsening. And of them, 10% of them were reviewed by a consultant and put up the queue to go first. So what the first thing this kind of very streamlined triaging process will do is enable you to pull out the patients who are at higher risk and make sure they kind of get to the front of the queue first. And whilst everybody else has been communicated with, they've got a letter from their consultant that says, I've reviewed your letter, I think you're okay, but if your symptoms change, contact me. So that's the first thing. The second thing is it improves the productivity downstream of the pathway as well, because it may be, and we know this, about 10 to 15%, so one in 10 patients, the GP has actually done all the work themselves. And they're asking a question from a doctor, the consultant, who doesn't need to see the patient. And so the doctor is saying, look, dear GP, dear patient, everything has already been done. Here is how I would manage it forward. You don't need to come and see me. You don't need to wait for that. There are patients with more complex problems that I need to see. You can deal with yourself. Now, some of your listeners, especially if they're GPs, would be worried that saying, hang on, you're going to give us more work back. One of the key elements of this is for about one in 10 patients, there genuinely is no extra work to be done at hospital. And it's, but the patient's been referred either because the patient really needed reassurance of a doc specialist saying it's okay, or the GP wasn't comfortable with it. And it's understandable. They're dealing with every single condition under the sun. They're not the specialists in it.
Right. So how does this communication happen between the consultant and the patient? Is this electronic? Is it letters? Is it a telephone call?
So we've been through this quite a bit to find a middle ground that enables productivity but prevents exclusion. So we start off at the moment, we start off on a letter as a base for everybody. And then people can opt out into digital. And the reason we did it that way was because we didn't want to start with digital, and there are some patients who would be excluded. And then they may not even receive it or don't know, and they won't be able to say, I want a letter. So you see, we went this way around to make sure patients are not digitally excluded.
Okay.
So then the key is that if that consultant needs more information, they can then arrange what we call a virtual consultation or a telephone consultation, where they'll get that patient will then get a phone call by one of our team, a suitably expert member of our team. If that consultant is happy that the investigation that patient needs is clear and no more information is required, then they can send them immediately for that investigation. But we've also built into our pathway that there are some patients who will need a face-to-face review for some reason. They may need their joint examined in rheumatology, or they may need someone to actually look at the problem that they have, in which case the patient can then go into that stream. So from the patient's perspective, they get an expert review within that 48 hours. And then that might result in them going straight to a test. It might result in them having a telephone call. It might result, as Bamman says, in 10% of them, the GP getting advice about how to manage the condition, or it might result in that face-to-face review. So from the patient's perspective, what's important is they're getting that expert care within the 48 hours.
Right. Okay. So this is really virtual management of something that is happening already.
Virtual first is what we tend to call it, because lots of the patients will have a face-to-face interaction with the person doing the ultrasound or the person doing their endoscopy in if they're, you know, looking down their throat into their stomach. So there'll be lots of face-to-face interactions, but it's virtual first, which is where you get that efficiency and you get that ability to use your workforce in a distributed way, that micro time we talk about of the consultants.
So I know you've done this as sort of models, testing it out in a couple of places. How do the patients take to it?
When they know they're going into this kind of a service from the point of view of the GP, they absolutely love it. Because right. they know how it's working. It's a very human thing. You want to know what's about to happen to you. And going into a healthcare environment is nerve-wracking for everybody. It's a time of anxiety. So you don't know. So as long as you know what is going to happen and how the environment works for you, then patients are quite happy. And actually, over the years, when we've received the patients, we've tweaked how we interact with them as well. And we've recently actually changed a model to introduce a welcome call, because we appreciate that not every patient gets the level of detail from their GP to understand exactly how the service runs. When we work in areas where the patient has already been, because we also help NHS hospitals to clear their backlogs, at that point, then we always give the patients a choice who might say, well, look, I've been waiting in this queue. I'm comfortable in that environment. I wasn't sure of this, so I want to stay in that one. So we always give them the choice of saying, if you feel uncomfortable with this, that's fine. But one of the things we find most of the time, patients are just worried that they will lose their place in queue. So as long as you reassure them of that, actually the less than 1 in 100 patients who doesn't like this kind of a model when they realize how much faster it is and they get exactly the same quality of care. And in fact, we can demonstrate, and we've been doing this work, which if you want, we can go into more detail later. We've built so many metrics into our service because it's now a digital service and a back end as well of monitoring our doctors, the outcomes, the output. So we know we monitor our doctors and consultants and the specialists in a way that no hospital can do right now.
Okay, that's interesting. One thing that I know is a big issue, a big problem, and that's patients often not showing up to outpatient appointments. So I guess a couple of questions. Why do people not show up? Because, you know, if there's something wrong with you, if you got that far, presumably there's something that needs fixing. And how does this system make that better or worse?
It makes it better, and we've got the statistics to show it. So, and then you need to understand why people don't show up, which is one of your questions. When you've been waiting for a very long time, a lot of patients will pay out of pocket. And by the time their appointment comes, they're actually sorted, but they may have forgotten they've got an appointment, so they don't turn up. I've been the recipient of this myself as a patient. The appointment letter has arrived to me after the date of the appointment. Yes. So sometimes you don't know whether you have that appointment. And the other one is, a lot of it is actually when you start looking at carers. So you're looking after an elderly, or you're on an hourly payment, so you have to work. And so it's a really inconvenient time.
Just on that one, I'm increasingly seeing this in the current economic climate. I'm increasingly seeing patients who tell me that they just did not feel comfortable asking their employer to have a couple of hours off to attend a hospital appointment because they're worried that it just may be held against them. And in a time when people are worried about their jobs, you know, they consider it a risk to take time off work to attend a physical inpatient appointment, a physical appointment in a hospital.
Goodness me. All right. That's another bigger social issue.
Exactly. Well, here's where it gets interesting. When you move into this model, two things happen. Firstly, the consultant, the doctors who may not be able to work until 10 o'clock in the evening in a physical environment, in a remote environment, we run clinics until 10 o'clock in the evening. We've got 7 days a week, 365 days a year. So you suddenly expand the time period. So if you're a carer, you can wait until your children have gone to sleep, or you put your elderly father to bed. You come back from... So it suddenly opens up the time period that you may not have been able to go. If you've got learning disabilities, or you've got difficult autism, and you may be uncomfortable to go at peak with lots of other people, you can get an appointment really late in the evening at your uncomfortable. We've had feedback from patients who absolutely love this. So we've been working in Staffordshire, for example, for 2 years now, and we've got statistics and data to show that for the two most deprived patient population groups in the society, this has improved access by 45%.
Goodness. All right.
So, and the do not turn up rates is tiny.
That's got to be a success in its own right. Chris, you were about to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say, Bamman just mentioned it himself, but Medifer's missed appointment rate is under 4% in that contract. If in my other NHS work where I see patients, I could get my missed appointment rate to 4%, I'd be a very happy person.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds excellent. So presumably that saves some money, because all this system, I'm sure it's complicated to make, and you said there's, you know, 12 years development. Sounds kind of expensive to me. So overall, massive investment, does it save the NHS any money?
Absolutely. And when you look at it from the different aspects of it, is from when a patient was supposed to be seen and they didn't, so the resources go to waste. So that's an expense of the NHS that we've reduced. When you start looking at the fact that we are maximizing the patients at the speed of the care, so we're reducing the harm that comes to the patient, so that patient has a much lower cost to their healthcare than if they waited. So we've got, for example, evidence, and this goes back to East London, where we've been working, and the government actually referenced our work in the NHS Online announcements. In that area, we demonstrated that this service can actually reduce A&E admissions by 50 per month. So you're pulling care forward. So that moves it towards the preventative area. So that's cheaper to look after the healthcare. And actually, the other aspect of it is, by getting patients treated sooner and not, you'll get them back into work. So I recently saw a statistics that something like 1 in 5 people in the country are not fully economically productive because of ill health. So that kind of starts pushing the economy and the GDP up, which is another big topic area nowadays.
I think there might have to be a few follow-up discussions here, because we've opened all sorts of very interesting topics. Yeah,
in Barking Heybridge and Redbridge Trust, where we worked, and we saw 55,000 gastroenterology patients were managed by Medifer. One of the fascinating factors of that was when we look at the time that we were engaged with that trust and we were working with that trust, the number of patients presenting as an emergency with colon cancer, which is a really bad outcome for the patient. Emergency diagnosis of cancer is never a good thing. Went from being significantly higher than the national average to significantly lower than the national average during the time we were working with them. And
over
we
what
believe
time period was that then, Chris?
That was over how many years, Bamman?
It was 8 years.
8 years.
Actually, I want to put this into a bit of a context, because over there, we were actually, so your listeners may not know this, but the way the NHS contracting works, you can either be contracted by something called the commissioners or the NHS hospital itself. So in that area, in Barking, Heybridge, Redbridge, our contract was with the commissioners. And so we were getting referrals to us before it went to the hospital. And the over 8 years, what this meant was, because we were managing about 80-something percent of the patients entirely ourselves, who never then went to the hospital, the hospital was completely freed up. Instead of kind of constantly trying to catch up with waiting lists, they were able to kind of fundamentally transform how they were working. So the example I gave about the A&E reduction, so I was in a partnership award with one of their leads a couple of years ago, and he said, "Bam, when you guys started, I was seeing a lot of patients." So he was a specialist in inflammatory bowel disease. And he was telling me how he was seeing lots of patients who had nothing to do with inflammatory bowel disease, because there were just so many patients coming through with bloating and issues that needed to be dealt with, but were not his specialist, subspecialist area. And as we took all of that away, he was able to set up hot clinics, which basically in NHS means patients who are having a deterioration of symptoms, they can contact and say, "Can you see me quickly?" And that he would see them within a couple of days. Right. And so these patients were being seen much more proactively by the specialist team at the hospital themselves, because we had taken away a whole cohort of patients that could be dealt with remotely. And as the outcome of that, those patients were not deteriorating to the point they needed to be admitted in the hospital through an accidental emergency. So it's a whole system transformation when you look at it that way.
All right. That does sound very impressive. On a slightly different topic, lots of medical information for lots of people is sloshing around in the NHS in all sorts of different pockets. And you said part of this is finding a consultant who's kind of got some spare time, that sounds not quite right, but had in their busy working day can see some more patients, what have you. So pointing patients to different consultants, etc. I mean, it's bad enough at the minute to get the right information with the right patient. I can imagine that being even more difficult, to keep the right information with the right patient when they're actually seeing or talking to a consultant. How do you get over that?
So it's a very fair point. trying to bring the entirety of the clinical information into one pot is an incredibly difficult challenge. The NHS tried to do this about 15, 16 years ago with the national...
Wasn't it called something like that?
It ended up being the spine, which was a more watered-down version of what they tried to do. It was incredibly complicated back then. It's still not easy to do. But the times have changed. So almost every hospital now has an electronic health record system. The GPs have electronic health record systems. In many regions, pretty much every region I am aware of, there is a shared care record between the different providers in that region. So when you do it on a regional basis, this is not impossible nowadays. What is a challenge, which I understand the NHS and Department of Health working on this, is to bring the NHS online to life, which is why it's projected for 2027, is making sure there is a national coverage to do this. So it is a difficult task to take the whole country's data sets and try to bring it into one ecosystem. Having said that, you could start with the smaller parts of the pathway. So I'll give you one example. Right now, you could be a patient in Southeast, let's say Devon, in Devon, and you could say to your GP, I want to be seen by someone in London. And your GP will send a referral which summarizes all of your records to someone in London. And that is your legal right to choose as a patient. It's called the patient choice, and everyone hopefully knows about it. So it is possible on episodic care to do this entirely safely. Mm-hmm. But when you want to go into population health, that kind of stuff becomes more complicated to connect everything together.
Okay. So it's... You're working on it kind of thing. We're getting there.
But that data set, and we alluded to this a little bit earlier on, that data set is so valuable to prove that the care you're delivering is the best possible quality care that you can. And we can do things in Medifer that the NHS can't do. We know exactly what our consultants are doing. We know exactly how many CT scans they're requesting. We know exactly how many times they're reviewing each patient. And we can see ones that are differing from their peers. And then our clinical leads for each speciality, who are in charge of that speciality, can then look at that data and can see, because sometimes it's because that consultant is doing really fantastic things and that's why they're differing from their peers. Sometimes it might be because they're using the services slightly differently, but we have that oversight to prove that what we're doing is safe and effective. Whereas in the NHS, we generally don't have that oversight. In the NHS, generally speaking, people are working, doing their independent thing, but it's very difficult to understand what they're doing and how they're delivering their care. And I think that quality and that governance aspect of it is really very important.
And I would just add, actually, this isn't an NHS issue. I think this is the modality of care issue. So even in the
it's a healthcare issue. Yeah.
Even in the independent sector, if you go to a non-NHS hospital, if you're running it on an old-fashioned where you don't have all the right systems to connect the data points together, you won't have the same level of oversight on the consultant. So I think it's important that we highlight this is. It's about how you shift the model of care. It's not an NHS versus non-NHS.
But it's one of these other advantages of digital. It's not just about digital putting people in front of patients quicker. It's about having much better oversight over those pathways, much better governance to make sure safe care is being delivered. There's a lot more advantages to that digital approach than just that.
Okay. I mean, during our discussion, you've mentioned a couple of examples where this kind of system is in place and is working. Can you give sort of one maybe large example of an area where, or a particular hospital or something, where it's happening and it's happening today and it's
sure.
working?
So at the moment we've got a big service going with Isle of Wight that we've been supporting the hospital for the last 5 years across a number of different specialities. We're working in, I've referenced Staffordshire and Stoke-on-Trent, where we're delivering a few specialities there as well. We're working in around Norwich area, supporting some of those hospitals. Historically, we've worked over 20 to 30 NHS hospitals and commissioners as well. And we are in discussions with quite a few commissioners and hospitals around England. and the other health ecosystems about how we can help support and expand it. So hopefully over the course of next year, we will be in bigger parts of that country.
That was going to be my next question, actually. What of the future? Will the whole of the NHS be run by you guys soon? And is that a good thing if it is or not?
So our vision within Medifer has been to try to get to what I describe a national grid model. So if you think about the national grid, where you have the power stations delivering electricity, individual homes can have solar panels for their own use but sell the excess capacity, and then the national grid controls where the load goes and where it's needed. For when you look at the elective care, which is when you and I know is going to see a doctor in a hospital, that can be done in that model, which is what we've been trying to do. Now, I don't think it's appropriate for Medifer to run the whole part of the NHS itself, certainly not from a clinical service. The whole idea is the NHS hospitals have an enormous amount of capacity already within them. Those consultants who have been contracted by the NHS already have an enormous amount of capacity. It's about how we, and by we, I don't mean necessarily Medifer, but how can we as a nation tap into that and make it more efficient? So this is where I'm very excited about the NHS Online. And obviously, I mean, I've been part of the elective recovery task force with the previous government, and also have had conversations with NHS England. At the moment, we're not part of the NHS Online, but we're very happy and we have shared a lot of our learning, some of the stuff around safety, how you can create those protocols to make sure that how you run a service, you don't lose a patient, how you can monitor the consultants, all the stuff that we've talked about here today. So we're very happy to share that with any system, whether national or local, that they would be interested to hear from us.
Okay. This is fascinating stuff. I really enjoyed talking to you today. So thank you very much for taking the time. And I'm quite sure, you know, this topic is just going to go on and on. So I'm hoping that in a few months' time, you'll be back to give us an update and we can see how it's going.
Thank you very much.
We'll be delighted.
It's been great talking to you and your listeners. We'd be delighted to continue this conversation.
Good. Thank you. And thank you very much for your time just now.
Thank you again.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show. And they were Dr. Chris Peter and Dr. Baman Nadia Zakawi talking about digital health and the organisation of the NHS. Before I go, I would just like to remind you about my book, Cut the Crap. Ask the questions that matter about your health. Based on many of the wonderful discussions with past guests on the Relax Back UK show, the book's objective is to get the reader to ask questions about their health, of themselves and also the people who are helping them with all their health and different health topics. A good read for anyone who's interested in health, and is available on Amazon. It is an excellent Christmas present, and Christmas is coming. Thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.